I noticed that the reader's copy has a different dust jacket. That was
because the jacket was not done. That the first one is the sketch for the second one.
Ah.
They came in with a jacket that I could not abide, and they tried to make me eat it, and I said, no, I said, I can't, that's not going to go on my book. And they said, well, what do you want? So I took a pencil, and I sat down, and I drew that sketch.
That sketch.
Uh-huh. And so they took it to a painter, and he did that. That's a blow-up, actually, of the sketch that he did, which was much smaller. And they said, well, is this what you have in mind? I said, it's exactly what I have in mind, except change the time of the day. That's either too early in the morning or too late in the afternoon. I said, I want it bright and cloud-filled and just as clean and brisk as it can be.
That's odd. Some authors have no say at all in their choice of dust jackets at all. You know.
Well,
so
and some
clout with Knopf.
And some publishers tell you to go screw if you mess around with your jacket. I happen to be trained. I was a trained artist and designer, and I designed a lot of that sort of thing. We've had 7 books out, and that means a lot of sketches and things. And I've always been involved, and they've been very nice about allowing me to be involved in what I felt my jackets should look like.
Well, it doesn't hurt to get on the writer's good side anyway. Sometimes publishers, after the manuscript is in and it's printed and everything, they really don't want to see the author until it's time
yeah.
to promote the book.
Yeah, I know. It's not that way at Knopf. We're a very small company, and it's very, very family. And this is my 20th year there. I've been with Knopf 20 years last May. So I'm, you know, I'm kind of part of the family.
Oh, it's a wonderful publishing house.
They
do the just about the best books in the in the business.
Very classy.
Two or three other. Viking is good, and Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Those are the big three as far as I'm concerned. I do mostly those. I mean, if someone looked at my list of the interviews, they will see the focus probably on those three houses.
Yes.
Houghton Mifflin is up there, too.
Yeah, that's a good house. But I don't think anybody makes a better book than Knopf.
Oh, no, the Knopf cares about it.
The discussions about the paper.
Yeah, even in the back. I have yet to see a book that didn't have a note on the type.
It will. It does. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think Alfred instituted that when I first came to Knopf, and I was editing the galleys of the other. And they needed space for me, and they needed a desk. I used to sit at Alfred Knopf's desk at Random House, Knopf, and do my galleys. Boy, I'll tell you, that was exciting.
In that big seat. Did you ever see did you read the book Geek Love by Catherine Dunn?
Oh, yes.
Did you notice the little Borzoi?
Yes.
With the deformed...
Yes.
Three front legs.
Well, they do that for special things like that, but there wasn't really anything we could do about our Borzoi on these jackets.
It wasn't necessary.
That would be, you know, somehow ingenious or amusing or interesting. And yeah, you're right. It wasn't. When I first came home to tell my family that I was going to be a published author, up in Connecticut, and we were sitting around the screened-in porch, swatting at the flies, and waiting for dinner, and I made the announcement that I was to be published. Mother said, oh, dear, who is going to publish your book? And my father kind of leaned back in his wicker chair, and he put his hands behind his head like this, and he said, I bet it's the one with the dog. And I said, why? He said, well, aren't they the best? And I said, well, yes, they are. As a matter of fact, they are the best. He said, well, it's the one with the dog. So in our family, that kind of became a family joke. I have the one with the dog.
Scoot up just a little closer there, Tom. So.
I can't get over these cables.
No, it's not the most.
Maybe, how's that?
Yeah, that's better. Well, Pequot Landing, Connecticut, that has appeared in at least two other of your books.
Let me think.
Three. And that's kind of, another name for Weathersfield.
It is. That's my name for Weathersfield. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time before I decided on that name. And I think people tend to think that the name refers to those names of little river towns where there was a landing. So, you know, we're going down to Jones's Landing and get some shad, or this landing, that one. But this is based on the historical incident when the Pequot Indians, a fierce and hostile, marauding tribe of Indians that lived down around New London, came up the river to this little settlement of Weathersfield and came into the cornfields and just massacred the whole place, carried off the women. It was very Roman, the whole thing, because of that, they landed there on the river in the cove, and that's where Pequot Landing came from.
And so you were born in a town just like Pequot Landing, small.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling, I have a theory, maybe you can confirm this, that people who write, sometimes growing up in a small town is an enhancement, because the surroundings are so vivid, the people are so vivid, you get to know them so well, the relatives are there and the neighbors are there. And someone like myself grew up in a dozen towns in the Midwest, and some of them large cities. I don't have a real sense of identity to any one place, but I think you do.
I have had a very strong identity to this place, both the actual Weathersfield and the fictional place. When I was about, I must have been about five or six, they were celebrating the tercentenary anniversary of the founding of Weathersfield, which is the oldest town, village in the state. And they were putting on this big pageant, and they reenacted the Pequot Massacre. And God, I wanted to be in that thing. I kept seeing all these guys going around in pilgrim outfits and carrying blunderbusses and everything. If there was some way I could have schemed my way into that show. My brother did. He got to be a pilgrim boy, but I didn't. And I think it screwed up my psyche something terrible.
Well, it could have been worse. You could have been the turkey.
Yes. Yeah. But I have always felt that town had a specialness about it, mainly because it was so involved, truly involved, in all of the major events of our very early colonial history. I mean, we sent men from Weathersfield to the Lexington Alarm to answer that call. And we had men at Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill. Washington slept in our town on three different occasions.
Probably in your bed.
Well, we lived in a street that didn't exist at that point. They planned the Battle of Yorktown at a table in Weathersfield, Connecticut. The table is still there. And you can go and look and see where George Washington sat, and General Rochambeau, and all the aides-de-camp, and all these other people. And the architecture of the houses. We have one of the prettiest churches in Weathersfield of any of those old New England white spire, Christopher Wren type churches.
I see it right on the front cover. There,
and that's it. He worked from the photograph, and it has a lot of finials and kind of extra decoration that the more plainer edifices of that sort never attained.
Tom, your many fans will probably, people who have enjoyed your horror stories and your movie stories, will probably be surprised to find out that you've written a historical romance. This is a, kind of a departure for you, isn't it?
Mm. Yes, it really is. Looking back on it now, it seems like such a perfectly natural thing for me to have done. And as a matter of fact, somebody recently pointed out that, hey, I read your book. You got another gothic murder mystery going here. And I said, what do you mean murder mystery? I said, this is a historical novel. He said, well, it's all about a murder. And I said, oh my God. I hadn't realized until that moment that all of book one concerns itself with that diabolical mass murderer, that madman who ran around, and he's historical. I found him in a book of history of the town, and he and his family and all of those events helped to shape the whole beginning of the whole novel. I don't know whether we've talked about the fact that there are four of them and that they form a quartet called the Kingdom Come Quartet.
Right. Oh, yeah, no, we haven't gotten to that point yet. But let's work up to that a little bit and talk about the Winds of Morning and the people in it, because as I began reading the book, I encountered dozens and dozens of characters. I mean, mm-hmm. Really, although the focus is on two families, the Talbots and the Grimes, as I recall.
Talcotts,
that's right, and the Grimes. And there's a little bit of Romeo and Juliet in here, the two warring families and the boy and the girl who fall in love. And
mm-hmm. So.
How did you come to develop these characters and these families?
Well, originally my idea was, going back to the history of the town, I had unearthed all this fascinating material. It was fascinating to me. And I thought, there's something here. I should do something with this material. So I decided what I was going to do was write the history of the town from the time the first settlers arrived right up until whatever year it would be I would finish the book. And in those days, I was thinking of finishing the book at about 1980. So, you know, that's the way it appeared at the time. And when I submitted to my editor a 40-page précis of this thing that I had concocted, a storyline, he read it. He said he wanted to do it. He liked it. But then he opened up the folder and undid the little chrome clip and pulled out the middle four pages. And he handed them across the desk to me, and he said, I would like you to give me these. And I looked at him like he was screwy, and I said, that's only a very small part of the book. And he said, this is where your heart is. He said, this whole thing is a Michener book. And he said, do you want to do a Michener book? And I said, no, Jim Michener does very well. He doesn't need me to do a Michener book. And I saw what he meant, mm-hmm. that in trying to show the history of the town through the eyes of these two families who had been close friends, who had traveled from England back in 1633 to the New World and had come to this little town and were farming side by side, they'd had a falling out. And what had been a mere falling out had over the generations and the centuries become an ugly blood vendetta. And I said, aha, I will show my story through the eyes of these two families who, while both were important families in the history of the town, were totally different characters. I guess it was inevitable that the son of the one house would fall in love with the daughter of the other house.
That's the focus in this first volume, the love affair between
St. John and Grimes Aurora. And Aurora.
And, but, and the and in a way, the central figure is a the girl, I think she's the Miller's daughter, Georgiana.
Georgiana.
Almost the focus seems to go through her, actually.
Well, it does. You see, once having set those other two characters up, I then introduced the third character, which now got me off the hook as far as Romeo and Juliet was concerned, because I'm not telling the story of Romeo and Juliet. I introduced this character of this girl whose figure you see there on the jacket design, but you see her from the back, and she has a mystery about her. She has she's the central figure of all four of the books. She forms a triangle with the other two. She is best friend to both of them, but she gets caught in the middle. And because of this feud, these murders, these grisly murders occur. And again, she is most deeply drawn into the effects of all that kind of grisly grotesquerie. In that regard, it kind of has the earmarks of a Southern Gothic novel in a way.
Oh, there's definitely a Gothic feel to it. There's no question about that. You start the narrative in what year or what period?
1828.
Now, of course, this is only the... Actually, you wrote this as a single volume, didn't you?
All four books were
as a single book,
constructed
as a single novel.
And written as a single novel. 5,800 pages.
Manuscript pages?
Yes.
5,000 manuscript pages?
Yes.
I mean, that should be about...
48 inches high. We measured it.
How do you keep track when you're writing something that big? How do you keep track of the
it's very
characters?
It's very strange, you know. For easily 10 years, I knew where every comma was. I knew every scene. I knew what every character was wearing. I knew where, on what page they had said that line. I knew on what page this event had happened. I don't know how it was. I kept the whole thing in my head. In my head. It was only when we broke it up into four books that I started to go crazy. You know, when did that happen? When did this happen? And I really had to kind of rein in and get control of the material again to give each of the books its closure, to give it a beginning and a middle and an end, and to make each of the books separately a happy reading experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. When you have a 5,000-page manuscript, how do you determine where one section of this manuscript, this book, is going to end and become a separate entity and another one picks up?
You get into bed, you pull the covers over your head, and you just lie there. And you may lie there for days, literally, and you just wait for it to come. And it comes. Now, I had to do it three times, because when we all saw the enormity of the size of the script, I said, it's got to be broken up into two books, little did I know. I said, you know, two volumes. And they said, well, you know, how would you do that? And where would book one end? And I said, well, let me think about it. So I got into the bed and pulled the covers up. And 5 days later, I crawled out and I said, Eureka, I've got it. And I wrote out a synopsis, and that I sent it in, and they called and they said, well, we like it very much, but we're not nuts about sequels. Could you turn it into a trilogy? I said, oh, come on. I said, I've worked all this time to divide it in half. Now you want to divide it into thirds. So by God, the same thing happened. I got back in the same bed, pulled up the same covers, stayed there 5 days, came out. I had the solution, and it was better now. It was better than it was as one long book or two shorter books. Now three books, it was fabulous. And we were, let's see, this was last October. We were pretty well along toward going to we went to copy editing on this book, and the word comes back that they're all saying the paperback houses are never going to buy it because it's too long. Now, originally they said, we want a really long big, juicy book. Now they had it, and they didn't know what to do with it. So, again, I called my editor friend at the New Yorker, Bob Gottlieb, and I said, Bob, I said, we really got a problem. He said, oh, no, blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, let me check around, and I'll make a few inquiries and so on. Called me back, and he said, Tom, you really got a problem. And I said, well, what's the answer? He said, you have to make it into four books. So back into the bed I went, and it became four books.
Hope you were able to finance a new box springs and mattress after all of this wear and tear.
Well, but how about getting paid for the extra books? How about that?
Well, that's an interesting concept. Do they pay you for one book, or do they pay you for four? That's interesting.
Well, I could only say in that regard that they've been very generous.
Do they give you four advances or one large advance?
They gave me one large advance, which I had to eke out over 13 years. So that meant that I was not making money hand over fist, and which was why I stopped during the interval and wrote two other novels.
But I would assume that even if you're working on a big book like The Wings of Warning, there reaches a point where you can't go any further. You have to stop and think, and what's my next turn? And this gives you a chance to do something else, whether it's going to the racetrack or writing another book or something like that.
I hated it. I hated having to stop and readjust my sights, and I don't think it did me any good about my perceptions or what have you. I just would have preferred to go on and get the darn thing finished.
But don't you get stuck on occasion and you have to
give
yourself time to get unstuck, like 5 days in bed figuring out how to divide the book?
Yeah, but I don't do that. You see, if I get stuck, and I'm really stuck, like in the other, I was stuck because I wanted that baby to pop out of the wine keg at the party. And how was I going to have that sweet little dear head come bobbing to the top of the Burgundy in front of all eyes to create the effect that I wanted? Well, that was go to bed for 6 weeks. But the answer came. The answer always comes if you just keep on thinking about it. I've never seen it fail. It's never failed for me. The answer always comes, plot-wise. Or sometimes it doesn't come plot-wise, it comes character-wise, which is more the case in Kingdom Come, Wings of the Morning.
Kingdom Come is the overall title, isn't it?
Yes, that's the title of all four books.
But it's not it's not on the cover.
Well, I think it's on the dust jacket, maybe on the copy of the the flap.
Oh, on the flap.
I think maybe that's explained there.
Well, what they should do is to have it parenthetically.
I wanted them to, but you see what you just did, the way you did with your finger, there really isn't room in there.
Put it right here.
He's pointing to my name.
This would be a terrific miniseries looking for television.
Yeah.
Any possibility of that?
Yeah, they're reading it. Yeah.
It really would be.
Well,
this is the kind of thing they're looking for.
Miniseries are in bad odor these days because the numbers have been so bad. I personally happen to think that Lonesome Dove was just one of the best things I ever saw.
You know, I like that so much. I taped it. And I watched it in one sitting. I mean, I think it ran
six nights, something like that. Yeah.
But I sat there on a Saturday morning and just watched. I couldn't get up. I could barely move after the end of it.
I think America is devoted to that form of entertainment. Now, The Winds of War and War and Remembrance, the first one got better numbers than the second one did. And I certainly wasn't in love with the show per se, but there was enough good stuff that kept me tuned in. And now last week we had that wonderful thing on the Civil War.
I saw some of that.
That network television would never have produced that, ever in the world.
I'm kicking myself I didn't tape that. I know it ran 11 hours, but I don't care. You know, put it on slow speed, 160 VCR minutes or whatever it is. 160 tapes.
I never know about that. I just push the buttons.
Well, now you wrote the 5,000-page manuscript. You turned it into the editor. You did a lot of editing. By the way, just before I ask that question, how does one rewrite a 5,000-page manuscript? I mean, most people rewrite or revise. You know, there are drafts and this sort of thing. But when you have a 48-inch high stack of papers,
well, you're smart if you never let it get stacked up like that. You keep it separated. See?
So you worked as you went.
And yeah, and you work on it as you worked. Part one, which was called Georgiana, wasn't called book one or volume one. It was just part one. And you work that to a certain point, and then you move on in your head in the story to the second part, which was called Rose, because Rose is a character who does not come in book one. She enters in book two, and it's her book. It's about her, this black slave who has run away, and now the book is dealing with issues that you don't really see in book one, but it's dealing very heavily with the issue of slavery as it obtained in the country in 1848 and the Dred Scott decision and all of that, and this new character is introduced. Now we milk the hell out of her. And we go on to book three, which is called Aurora, because now we're picking up the Aurora story again. And then we get to book four, back to Georgiana.
Well, it would be rather suicidal to spend 10, 12, 13 years writing this huge manuscript and then going back to the beginning to rewrite it. And I don't think you could do it without a word processor either.
Most of this book was done without a word processor. I only got a word processor 2 years ago. So most of this was done on an IBM Selectric.
That's right. If you started it, you said 12, 13 years ago?
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't have used a computer back
then. I wish I had one. I mean, the time that it would have saved me, and just on the research alone, which was an enormous thing, because in book three, Aurora, the whole story picks up and gets on a ship and goes off to China. And is going to, the whole story moves to China. I didn't know very much about 19th century China.
Tom, we're really just out of time. I had other questions about the degree of research and everything. I'm not going to be able to get all those in. But I did have a last question. Can you give the listener an idea about the timetable of these books and when they can expect the follow-ups?
Oh, yes, I can. This is the end of September, and this is my pub date week for the first book, which is Wings of the Morning. The second book, which begins about 8 years later, which is called By the Waters of Babylon. By the Rivers of Babylon, also plays in Pequot Landing, although more of the China influences are working their way into the story, and the issues, the political issues, sociological issues, are broadening out. So you have a feeling that the story is reaching out beyond this little Connecticut town. Book three, which is called The Gardens of the Moon, is very drenched in romance when the lovers sail away to China and get involved in all sorts of things in China, but still keeping the Pequot Landing folk alive and bringing them into the story. And book four, which is called The Song of the Wind, begins in China 10 years later, 15 years later, and then moves finally back to Pequot Landing for the end of the story.
So Knopf is planning a fall-spring schedule?
No, fall.
Fall. So fall, will be next fall.
This will be next fall. So this book is this fall.
Yeah.
And book two will be next fall.
So you're talking about spreading this over 4 years.
Yes. And then I have another book, which they're going to publish as soon as these have been published. They're going to bring that out. I will have finished it, but they won't let me do it until these have been published. So in the meantime, I'm writing children's books. That they'll let me do.
Well, Herbert Gold used to scream to anybody who would listen to him, said, "Stop me before I write more."
Oh, good advice.
Well, I think your readers will love this historical romance, Thomas Tryon. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don. Nice to see you.
Hang on.